Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hey guys, Alf speaking. Welcome back to the Macro Trading Floor. As always, with my friend and co-host, Brent Donnelly. Brent, how are you doing?
Hey Alf, I'm good. I'm in New York City seeing clients. It's always a nice change of pace down in Washington Square, which is a lot nicer than Midtown.
Fair enough. And you're also eating something they call pizza, which I wouldn't qualify as such. But okay, it's an experience.
And I'm going to Canada to pick up my son from university tomorrow. So it's a good week.
So you're going to add pineapple on the pizza then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, God. Okay. Talking about the US and how the narrative of nominal growth continues, we just had a GDP report for Q1 2024, which was quite interesting because real GDP disappointed expectations. Including the consumer side of things, wasn't necessarily that strong as expected. Still decent, but not as strong. But on the other hand, core PCE, the embedded part of core PCE that goes out with the Q1 GDP report, was way stronger than expectations. And so you get still the nominal growth part, which remains robust, but now the distribution between real growth and inflation becomes a bit less friendly looking at Q1. And the market is reacting, fixed income all over the place, equities are selling off. So what do you make of it?
It's interesting, especially in the context of the US PMIs this week, which were weak, and then you had the stronger PMIs in other countries. I find that there seems to be a lot of noise in the data overall. Like you have strong CPI in Australia, sticky inflation in the US, but then you have weak inflation in Canada and also weak in Europe. And it's interesting because we had this global cycle where every single data point was 100% correlated in 21, 22, and a lot of 23. And now as the dust is settling, you're starting to see a lot of different outcomes in different countries. So I think it's really interesting. The GDP, I'm not all that excited about today's numbers, although the inflation side does appear to remain a little bit concerning in the US. If you look, especially on the services side, there just doesn't seem to be that pullback towards 2% or even like to anywhere close to 2%. So I get why it's concerning, but I think we can talk about whether this is backward looking or forward looking.
Yeah, I think that's a valid question that you're putting out. To me, basically, we have seen so far in Q1 what I would call a reflation narrative. So effectively, if you think of the future nominal growth that the market is used to expect. As always, they don't have one data point, right? They have a distribution of outcomes that they expect. And we came into the year with this distribution being pretty narrow, pretty focused around one outcome, where GDP growth would be around trend, let's say 1.5%, maybe. That's where we started the year as an expectation. And then core inflation all the way down to 2. So that was the strong and, you know, fat body of the distribution as expectations. And then we got this reflation, right? I mean, core PCE will annualize on a 3-month basis somewhere around 3.5%. That's way higher than people were expecting. And so what you're doing is you are basically fattening the tails, especially the tail, not the recessionary tail, which was fat for a long time and wrongly so, as facts have demonstrated, but this time the right tail, the reflationary tail, right? And when you do that, of course, you generate vol, because what generates vol in markets is surprising the current distribution of pricing, okay? And in this case, the right tail was the surprise. And the reflation has, I think, worked through the ways you would expect it to work. So namely commodities, value developed market stocks. For example, if you look at European banks, they're making new highs every week. Not necessarily the first stock market you would think about buying, right? And yet value stuff is working, commodities are working, and bonds have sold off, right? We've seen this strong reflation. Question is it stopping? Are we at a turning point now that everyone is talking about it? I mean, what's your take there?
Right. And I mean, I do think that a lot has now been priced in, obviously, if you compare it to where we were, but even just to where we're going, it does seem to me like a lot is priced in now. One issue, I think, which I'm sure we talked about last week, is that there was kind of a cap on the distribution and the topside vol in rates for a while, because the market interpreted the Fed's communications as confirming that hikes were not a thing, and it was just a matter of when and how many cuts. And now it's getting a little bit dicey, because Williams opened up the other side of the distribution a little bit, saying like, well, you know, you never know, we could hike if we have to, depending on the data. And so that moment where Williams did that, I think was kind of, people were expecting it maybe at some point, but not this soon, has reignited the inflationary or reflationary volatility in the bond market. And so now my guess is that we're in a little bit of an overshoot phase, because if you look going forward, you look at like, say, what lumber's doing, which tends to be a forward-looking indicator for housing. Lumber's like collapsing, basically. Oil has not traded well on the Middle East stuff. So you kind of have a good news, bad price situation in oil. And then I don't know if you want to talk about it now, but I have a view on copper based on an interesting indicator that I got from a Bloomberg story. So to me, the forward outlook for copper is maybe getting a little peakish as well. So to me, I think we're probably now in the overshoot phase for yields, where, you know, yields get momentum and volatility gets momentum and it feeds on itself and people stop out. And that's the phase I think we're in. And then I think, based on what we saw from the US PMIs, which was labor market concerns embedded in there, and then based on what oil's doing and what I think copper's going to do, and also based on the QRA, which, I mean, it's not never a guarantee, but if you're going to bet hawkish or dovish with Yellen over the last 15 years, dovish was always the bet. So yes. To me, I think we're in a bit of a, I wouldn't say blow off because it's not that dramatic, but I think we're in an overshoot phase for yields, where now yields are getting a little bit too high.
Yeah, I share the view on yields. So before we jump to the commodity story, which I think is important, you have made a reflection on the reflexivity of the process, right? I mean, there is this reflation story, but then if the dollar goes too high or yields sell off too aggressively, real yields go too much high, what happens is that obviously you'll have stock market suffering, and then you have this weird reflexivity type of theory where the dollar goes higher, emerging markets suffer, commodities suffer, stock markets suffer, and then all this reflation narrative all of a sudden doesn't seem so compelling anymore. Before we jump to copper, because I think you have some interesting stuff to share there, just to tell people what I see from my option implied models right now. So this is a model I use to try and extract the probability distribution of federal funds rate in 12 months from now. So we're looking at April as we speak, and looking at underlying options between behind the SOFR H5 contract, I can realize that the most observed part of the distribution today, so basically the most likely outcome according to option traders, is that the Fed in 12 months from now will deliver a whopping amount of zero cuts. Zero. That's what's priced today. Now, amazing. Of course, if you look at the H5, let me spell a bit of the jargon out. If you look at the March 2025 SOFR contracts, which basically incorporates the next 12 months ahead of us, it is pricing 1.4 cuts. So the model is zero, the most observed likely outcome according to option traders. And there is a little bit, of course, of left tail in the distribution, because we're talking about bonds, we're talking about rates. So people will always want to protect themselves, right, against a bit of a recession story or a soft landing story. So the average is 1.4 cuts, but the model outcome, Brent, is zero. So now if you're bearish here and you're saying, I'm a bearish stock markets, I'm long the dollar, whatever other iteration basically of this idea you have based on bond market have to sell off because the Fed is going to be hawkish. Yeah, well then hawkish versus forwards means that you have to basically start talking about hikes on a net basis here. You almost have to start talking about hikes if you want to be bearish fixed income, therefore leading your narrative of being, I don't know, long dollar or bearish stocks or whatever your derivative of that is. I think it's a very difficult hurdle, a very difficult forward market to beat right here.
Right. And like you said, the reflexivity starts to kick in. So initially we had sort of a positive or inflationary boom kind of trade going on. And then the inflationary bust comes when it starts to get a little bit too scary and people start repricing fixed income, and importantly, start repricing the volatility of fixed income. And to me, now we're in that little mini bust stage where, you know, the best cure for high prices is high prices. And as prices go up in commodities, eventually it's good at first, and then eventually it starts to hurt and scare people. And we're in that sort of scary phase. And then when you get to that point, then that actually becomes much less bullish for commodities because of the reflexivity. The yields go higher, growth is going to be dampened by higher yields, in theory, whether that's true or not, but in theory, that's what happens. And then the forward outlook for commodities becomes more challenged. And I think we're exactly at that point now. The other thing too is with emerging markets is that if you have commodities going up and a benign reflation scenario, that can be good for carry and good for emerging markets. But we're seeing, for example, Mexico, which is kind of the poster child for carry these days, kind of blowing up. So there was a massive blow up after we recorded last week. And then there's been another mini blow up today. And when you start to see that, that's not necessarily the environment where commodities are just going to keep on keeping on.
I share that point of view as well. Look, the thing you wanted to discuss is China in particular, where you have a view on copper. Now, why don't you tell us a bit that copper story, because I think it somehow ties to this devaluation chatter that I've been hearing a lot from my clients, hedge funds and so on this week. So talk us about copper and China for a sec.
Sure. So we'll start with a more idiosyncratic thing on copper, and then we can talk about the deval after. So this was not my idea. It's from an article that I read on Bloomberg. And the headline is China copper gauge at zero offers stark warning to metals bulls. And essentially what they do is they plot the premium of China versus London copper. And when things are good in China, you would presume the premium would be higher because China's buying more. And whenever I read an article like this, you know, or you see an article about a golden cross, bearish death cross, Hindenburg omen, whatever, like all that kind of stuff, I find that generally journalists just tend to take them at face value, whereas I'm more the opposite. I tend to be skeptical of these kind of things. And then I'll backtest them and see if they're actually true, at least in the past. Obviously, the past doesn't guarantee the future, but it gives you some clues as to the future. And when I backtested this, it actually comes out very directional. Like when the premium is very low, which should be bearish copper, it is bearish. Forward returns are like between 3 and 6% negative for copper over the next 1 and 3 months. And then when the premium's high, which is when copper's in demand in China, the forward performance of copper is between +4 and +10%. So you're getting like -3 to -6 in one regime and +4 to +10 in the other regime. And we're in the negative regime. So the premium actually is at the all-time lows. So it's rare for it to go below 25, and it's at one right now. Like it kind of moves in a range of 0 to 150 kind of thing, and it's at one right now.
Holy crap.
And copper's at the highs. So that's an interesting setup to me. And that would be my trade this week, would be bearish copper on it. Looking out a little bit more, like I normally do things that are more like 1 week, but I think this is more like a 1 or 2 month trade. And I think it makes sense on a few levels because of everything that we said earlier about the negative reflexivity of the reflationary trade now turning a little bit more like reflationary bust. And then this Shanghai indicator, which I thought was really interesting. We'll put the article in the show notes if people want to read it. And like I said, I did backtest it. And the sample size isn't gigantic, but I think when you have a smaller sample size and a logical explanation, which in this case, there's clearly a logical macro connection between the premium and what's going on in the real world, then I feel like the bar to the sample size, like normally you'd want a sample size, a rule of thumb would be like 30 instances of something that you're testing. But in this case, I have something like 15 or 20 instances, but I don't feel that that's a big problem given that it works in both directions, which is a good sign. And then also that there is a logical macro explanation.
Yeah, I mean, as you present this idea, I was just looking at the very simple slope of the copper curve. I was just curious to see if there was something special going on there. And it's not so special. So it must be really, rather than a copper market overall, more of a Chinese idiosyncratic story on copper, which, by the way, China is a very huge buyer of copper and commodities in the first place. So it has an impact. One thing I would generally caution people when it comes to, let's say, blow off tops or mean reversion trades in commodities is that, commodities are the bread and butter of CTA and generally trend followers, okay? Because guess what? Commodities in general tend to trend more often than other asset classes do. See cocoa, for example, recently, right? And so when you try to catch blow off tops in commodities, you should be careful, I would say, about how you risk manage that, right? Because basically what you're doing is you are assuming a sort of a mean reversion to a more, well, stationary type of pricing rather than a blow off continuous trending explosive price action. But, you know, you're doing that on an asset class that has that feature. Commodities tend to trend pretty often, both on the downside and on the upside, which in a second, I think, Brent, we should talk about stop losses here, because that's
sure.
A very interesting argument on a trading side. And we hear feedback from people that they like when we talk about trading and how do we try to not lose so much money, which is rule number one to stay alive in this business. But first on the China deval for a second, something I wanted to add there. Look, there has been a lot of chatter that China is ready to devalue because they are stockpiling commodities, okay? So they're buying gold, they're buying some other industrial metals. You can see these flows coming, and that means China is preparing to devalue, right? And look, there is one thing that I really don't get here. From a macro perspective, you devalue your currency when you're trying to boost your growth through exports. So basically, when you want to boost your manufacturing side of things and you devalue your currency and you make your exports cheaper for your buyers, okay? But now we have China that has a different set of problems. I mean, they have a deleveraging problem. They have an internal debt leverage real estate type of issue. I'm not sure what deleveraging will do about that, to be frank. And on top of it, what devaluing will do to solve that problem. But devaluing, so won't address directly the issue that China has, but on the other hand, it might bring some downsides. Because if you devalue your currency, even if you have been stockpiling some commodities, you are doing that at the price of oil priced in renminbi or a price of other commodities as priced in renminbi, which is pretty high. Last time China actually devalued was 2015, and oil priced in renminbi was way cheaper than it is today. So for China, which is a big importer of oil, devaluing where oil price in renminbi isn't very high in price, well, it's a risk you can somehow take. But devaluing today, when commodities price in renminbi are pretty high, it's quite risky vis-a-vis your benefits, which would be stimulating exports, which is not what fixes a deleveraging problem. So from a macro perspective, I really wouldn't suggest to China that a devaluation is the way to solve it, to be frank.
Well, and the thing is, if Xi's trying to pivot or to transition from infrastructure to a more consumer-based economy, devaluing isn't going to help that. It's not going to help the consumer. It actually reduces consumer spending power, and it creates instability and probably triggers more outflows like it did in 2015. And I don't buy the commodity hoarding thing. I mean, if you look at what happened in 2015 when they devalued, none of this happened in 2015. Commodities didn't rally into it. And ironically, when they deval, the market sells commodities because it views that their buying power has been diminished. And also it's a sign of weakness. Like you deval when you're concerned about your economy. So actually what happened last time is commodities went down. Oil went down like 50% after, not immediately, but after the deval. So hoarding commodities right before a deval doesn't even make any strategic sense to me, because you know empirically that when you deval, commodities are going to go down. So it makes much more sense to let commodities do whatever, then deval, and then get on the bid. So even commodities valued in renminbi went down after they devalued last time. Yeah. So I don't buy it. I don't know. I just think that they're pursuing a stability policy, and it's pretty boring. But being long dollar China can still be a good trade. That's the thing, is that even if they don't deval, it's positive carry, although the front end of the rates market is not positive carry anymore. But generally, it's positive carry, and there is some tail benefits to owning dollar China. So I don't hate dollar China, but I don't think playing for a deval is correct.
I agree with you there, but it's, you know, one of these interesting theories that people like to throw from time to time. I don't think that's going to happen. So that would then reinforce your idea that actually, you might want to try and catch a little bit of a peak in commodities and in this reflation story. Now, problem. How would you approach this from a risk management perspective? Say you have a trending series in front of you, like copper recently, for example, and you say, okay, that's it. So basically you're trying to fade a big blow off trend. So how would you approach this from a trading perspective and a risk management perspective, Brent? And would you be using stop losses?
Right. Yeah. So that's been a problem that's been difficult to manage too in cross yen if you're playing for MOF intervention, is that where do you put your stop loss? So generally I always start with charts and technical analysis, usually pretty basic stuff like horizontal lines. But then ideally what I would like is some kind of volume, like a surge in volume and reversal on the same day. A lot of times those are capitulation moments. Like if you get one year high in volume, new high in price, and then you close lower, those kind of setups I find are good. Another really basic way is like sometimes say you were trying to short cocoa and you know it's at the all-time highs and there's no chart points that you can look at, then I'll just use vol. So I'll look at like, okay, what's the average 3-day move, and you know if I'm looking to be short for the next week, use 3-day move, average 3-day move times 1.5 or something like that. Like then you're really just sticking your finger in the air at that point. And actually I had an interesting discussion on, I'm not going to put this in the stupid or smart category because it's kind of in between. It's just interesting, but neither stupid nor smart. But someone asked on Twitter, if stop losses are negative EV, then why use stop losses? And the question arises because if you look at the research on most strategies, like if you just take a basic trend following or mean reversion strategy, most of them perform worse if you use stop losses. So your sharp might not necessarily change, but your returns will normally be lower because you'll get chopped up a little bit. So then, well, why use stop losses? Because if you're doing a very low volatility systematic strategy, then fine, you don't necessarily need them. If you have 50 uncorrelated low vol strategies all running, you can let those things all run by themselves. But if you're a leveraged speculator, the reason you use stop losses is that maximizing EV is secondary to minimize or eliminating risk of ruin. So if you look at it, there's this irony of people like Niederhofer and Jesse Livermore and that, who are some of the most famous speculators. The fact is they just blew up a lot too. And in the end, maybe their stories were somewhat cautionary tales. So to me, if you want to be in the industry for more than 4 years, you need to use stop losses as a leveraged speculator, because otherwise you're just going to blow up just because of variance. Like even if you're you have a 75% hit rate because you have the biggest edge ever in whatever strategy you're doing, variance just says that you're going to hit a run of 10 bad trades. And when that happens, if you don't have stop losses, then you're done. And then you got to look for another job.
Yes. So I would say that there is a path dependency in P&L. So when you say, hey, I have a strategy, look at this, it goes up and to the right the whole time. Sure, you're looking at the end point of your strategy, but you should focus on the path to get there, because if by trying to get there, you have one of these drawdowns where you will lose your job, then I would say that stop losses are positive expected value. Now, as you said, Brent, if you're running something that is instead a very well-constructed mean reversion strategy, where effectively you're saying, look, there is no trend that can go against me because I'm doing long short a pair that, you know, I can show or I can demonstrate that it trades very sticky within these boundaries, then of course stop losses make way less sense, right? Because you can just play the extreme and play for the mean reversion, and the stop losses are just going to chop you out, you know, from time to time, and you don't want that. But if you're trading, let's say a bit more directional, a bit more leveraged, and you're trading something that might have a trend against you, it's not a small move, but a trend against you. If you get a trend against you and you don't have a stop loss, what will happen to the distribution of your returns is that the left tail will be very long, very, very long. And by being very long, it means you will have a few trades that will account for, no, they will take off 80, 90% of your PLN in a year. And you don't want that, right? You want the opposite. You want to truncate your left tail and to extend your right tail as much as possible. So it really depends on your strategy. But I would say most people are not doing this, sophisticated, low vol systematic mean reversion type of approaches, most people are taking some levels of directionality in their trading, right? And when they do that, you need to be careful of avoiding big trends against you and capturing the trends in your favor. And the only way to avoid the big trend against you is, I think, putting a stop loss there.
Right. And then even in the case of what you're describing, like long short or RV, the biggest blowups happen in that stuff because people are doing, say, the futures versus spot basis in gold. And okay, it never gets above 10 bucks. It's always like minus two to plus 10. Let's say that's what your model says. But then one day COVID happens and it goes to plus 100 and you're dead if you don't have a stop loss. So unless you have unlimited capital and you work at a bank, then maybe you can survive. But any speculator doing those types of RV trades without a stop loss, yeah, sure, in the back test, it's EV optimal. But in terms of utility, the stop loss is it's like insurance, where it's like, okay, you've calculated that it's not positive expected value to buy fire insurance for your home. But what you're doing is, by buying insurance, is you're hedging catastrophic loss. And stop losses essentially can function in that same way.
Yeah, it's a career risk protection and also an investor behavior hedging, right? I mean, if you have investors, they're backing you in a fund, for example, you will not want to freak them out by having a 20% drawdown month because they could withdraw all at once. So clearly, it's a lot of path dependency, right? On the journey to try and make consistent risk-adjusted P&L, there is a path dependency, right? And that path dependency needs somehow to be protected. Again, there are exceptions, but mostly I would say, saying broadly that stop losses are negative expected value, I think it's a bit too much of a generalization. But okay, enough trading. There is something else going on as well, Brent, which is divergence in PMIs, in policy, idiosyncratic opportunities. We have something going on in Australia, something different going on in Canada. Want to comment a bit about that?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges is going to be that now that these divergences are appearing, the question becomes how much of it is noise and how much is signal? Because, and I don't know the answer to the question, but my question maybe to you would be, can inflation go up in the US and Australia and down to target in Canada at the same time? I mean, sure, maybe, because there's a lot more slack in the Canadian economy. But I think that's an important decision that you have to make as an analyst or as a trader or whatever, is figuring out ways to separate the signal from the noise, because everything was moving together and now it's not. But then how much weight do you put, for example, on the S&P global PMI that came out for the US, which was kind of weak, when you see every other country very strong? And I mean, my intuition would be that I wouldn't put tons of weight on it. I would wait for more data. But then the longer you wait for more data, then the more the thing gets priced in. If you wait for 15-week labor market reports before you decide to buy bonds, you know, you're going to be pretty late. So the tension in looking at these divergences is trying to figure out how much signal and how much noise. And then the other problem too is that, so like in the 1990s, there was the data that we still have, like claims, NFP, they were called the napalm or whatever was what ISM was called. And those were the main workhorse data points. And that's what people looked at. Now you have, like, if you want to look at inflation, I could literally, probably without even looking at a screen, tell you 40 different inflation series that people are looking at. So like from the private ones, like Trueflation, and then Supercore, you know, X Housing, you know, all the blah, blah, blah. So the problem is that it's kind of like you have too much information. You can see on Twitter, there's someone confidently arguing that inflation is below 2% right now, and someone else arguing it's about 5%. And then, so when you can't even agree on the facts, it becomes really difficult to debate what's going on, let alone forecast it. So to me, that's another challenge now. But overall, it does seem like we had a very, very coordinated economic cycle in 21, 22, and most of 23. And now we're seeing divergence. And the question is now identifying the points where it's real. Like in Canada, I think it's real. I think mortgage resets, just the tremendous amount of slack there. GDP is so far below trend. I mean, there's so many things going on in Canada that to me, lower inflation in Canada makes sense and a more dovish Bank of Canada makes sense. But then some of the other stuff I find difficult to believe, like the weak PMIs in the US. But I mean, I'm open to it. I mean, we'll see if ISM confirms the S&P ones.
Yeah.
But like I said, you got to kind of make a call, because if you wait for everything to be crystal clear, then it's going to be priced in.
Yeah, that's one of the issues, right? So when it comes to more the signal rather than the noise, it's always hard to disentangle exactly where is the signal and where is the noise. I am trying to look at many macro variables. One of them is debt service ratios. So debt service ratio, Brand, is effectively what you just mentioned, mortgage resets and refinancing cliffs and floating rate loans and bonds that are getting repriced as central banks have hiked rates. So debt service ratio basically measures the amount of income or earnings that corporates or households are spending to service their debt. Okay. And it's a good metric, I think, to tell us which economies are actually suffering the most right now from a hiking cycle. Now, the BIS has public information on that, which is great. The issue is that it's 6 months old. So you're looking at something like the latest data are September 2023. So in the meantime, there have been another 7 months of hiking and pass-through of time and so on and so forth, right? But nevertheless, if you look at debt service ratios, the countries that have the highest debt service ratio as per September 2023 compared to their normal debt service ratio in their economy right now are Korea, Canada, Sweden, Australia, and Switzerland.
Those are the five. And just to clarify, is this corporate or households, or both, you combine
both,
them?
Both, corporates, okay, and households.
Okay.
We're looking at the entire private sector debt service ratios here. And if you look at the acceleration of these, so the increase in debt service ratios, from 2022 to September 2023, so from where the hiking cycle started until the data are available, you will see that the countries that have suffered, let's say where the debt service ratio has gone up the most, are indeed Australia, Canada, Korea, and now I'm going to mention a country that nobody expects, the US. So the US have seen a debt service ratio going up by 1.6 percentage points. It's not a lot. The debt service ratio in the US is 15.4%, which is bang in line per September 2023 with their 20-year average. But the trend is that it's slowly increasing in the United States as well. The negative outlier there, Brent, are Australia, Canada, Sweden, and Korea. These four countries, right, are the ones where the level is high, the level versus their historical average is high, and the trend in debt service ratios is negative.
Right.
And then,
No, go ahead.
No, I was trying to conclude there saying, look, I mean, there is a lot of noise. Like Australian inflation print was strong, for example, last week. So then what? I mean, that means that service ratio are not useful at all. Well, there's going to be a bumpy and noisy set of data, right? But if you believe in long-term macro, if you believe that higher interest rates are stimulative only temporarily, but ultimately when the private sector must refinance at higher interest rates, they must face high debt service ratios, then you can look at a few numbers that tell you that indeed Canada isn't looking great, Korea isn't looking great, and Australia isn't looking great either.
Right. And then I think ultimately that's the kindling or the gasoline or whatever analogy you want to use. And then ultimately it's when the jobs markets in those countries turn. Because if you think at the level of the individual household, if your debt service, you know, your MasterCard is bloated and you can barely make your mortgage payment and all that, you can find ways to make the payments if you are employed in your job that you had when you put the debt on. Generally, there's a match between the income, and even if it's the ratio is high, there's a match between income and debt servicing. And so the debt servicing goes up, you start cutting corners and a little bit less Starbucks and whatever, or you make the minimum payment by using your MasterCard to take money out and make the minimum payment and all that. There's a lot of ways people can service debt when they have a job, but when you lose your job, then just the dominant, like the house of cards, falls down. And so to me, these vulnerable economies have skated through okay because the jobs markets have been very strong. And so to me, that's the catalyst for all these countries to really get slammed, is when the jobs market turns. But I mean, hey, that could be in 2026.
Yes. at least one thing you can follow with a nice 6 months delay in data, unfortunately, is debt service ratios. I think it's interesting as a metric to follow. Okay, Brent, look, as I said, when it comes to trade ideas this week, the only thing I can share is that I've dipped my toes in 10-year treasuries. You've also mentioned it at the beginning of the show. You know, this reflation thing is pretty robustly priced right now. And so you can trade a few ways, right? You can short commodities. Maybe you want to start being a bit long bonds at a certain level. But the idea is this reflation narrative seems a bit stretched to me. Do you have any particular way to implement that?
Well, so we're on the same page, and I think the simple expression for me is just to be short copper. You could structure it either through options or spot or futures or however you trade. I don't think it matters that much. Essentially, over the next 1 to 3 months, to me, the returns for copper are skewed super negative. So to me, however you want to structure that, I think that's a good trade. So that's my idea this week.
Yeah, also, it's interesting to check whether if you go around and say this idea to people and say, hey, I heard two bold guys on a macro podcast, they suggest the reflation theme is over and maybe you should try and buy some bonds tactically or short copper. And what would this person say to you as a feedback? Probably get out of here. Are you nuts? You're buying bonds, you're selling commodities. Can't you see that this is reflation? This is probably the feedback you get today, I
Well,
guess.
you know, it's interesting because I mean, as you know, I publish a thing every day, and I do find the tenor of the feedback has information in it. So if some people agree, some disagree, whatever, it's when I get a lot of angry replies, then I know that I'm onto something because that's a really strong contrarian indicator is when people, not that people disagree with me, but it's more like the visceral emotional aspect of it. Sometimes you can detect that, like, oh, people are like 140% long this thing, and they're angry that I'm even suggesting that it's a bad idea.
Fair enough. So try that. If you can follow our thesis, you can, of course, disagree with us and you should whenever you want. But if you follow the idea, go out and pitch it to a colleague or a friend and say, hey, I'm selling commodities and I'm dipping my toes in bonds. If they scream at you, then
Then double down.
probably you're onto something.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I think this was it for the week. Brent, any parting words?
No, I guess we'll keep waiting for Godot, also known as the Ministry of Finance of Japan.
Is there a Japanese way to say Godot? I don't know. I need to look it up. Guys, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us. We'll be back again next Friday, as always.
Right, thanks, Alf. Have a
Ciao.
good weekend,
The
everybody.
content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.